This is Line One, your health connection, a weekly program produced at the studios of KSKA. Each week, KSKA's host, Dr. Thad Woodard, puts you in touch with local and national experts in a variety of health and family issues. Opinions expressed are those of the host, guest, and callers, and do not represent those of KSKA, the licensee, or the underwriters. Here's your host, Dr. Thad Woodard.
Good afternoon. Welcome once again to Line One, your health connection. Before we get started on today's program, I'm going to follow up an idea that I started last week, and that's discussing what are called logical fallacies. When you're listening to an argument, when you're trying to decide whether something's true or not, often people use what's called logical fallacies. They say things that really have nothing to do with the argument at hand. And they're so common that we sometimes forget about them. Well, last week we talked about argument from authority. That means just because somebody seems to have an authority on a topic doesn't mean necessarily that what they're saying is true. A subtype of that, which I'll mention today, is the argument from conspiracy or anti-authority. And what that basically is the argument that since it must be coming from an authoritative organization or person, that it's probably wrong. That's often used in the context on government positions on things. And the reason I bring it up is I think that's probably exactly the opposite. I think most government positions try to be unbiased and well-documented. But remember, primarily, when you're listening to arguments, it's not what people are saying. It's what their evidence and the logic they're using that should help you determine, not because it comes from any particular person, place, or thing. And the other thing I want to bring up before we get into today's program is to remind everybody about influenza. There's a lot of misconceptions about influenza. Influenza is not all the flus out there. We have a tendency in our society to use the word flu to mean any vomiting and or diarrheal illness that comes along. Most of those are simple, not very complicated, not very dangerous illnesses that are caused by a number of respiratory and gastrointestinal viruses. True influenza is a very significant illness. It happens each year, mainly in late winter primarily. It's primarily a respiratory illness, can have some gastrointestinal symptoms, could last a week or 10 days, and has particularly bad outcomes in people at high risk, such as the elderly, people with lung and heart disease also. And because of this, in the United States, there's close to about 35 to 36,000 deaths each year and more than 200,000 hospitalizations. The vaccine has some side effects, as you might recognize or might expect, but most of them are local, such as soreness or redness at the site of the injection for a day or two. Sometimes they're now with the new live virus vaccine that they're using in some individuals through a nasal spray, you might get a little nasal congestion. But in general, the risk of the vaccine are far, far, far less than the risk of the illness. I encourage everyone to think seriously about getting immunized. I did. My kids do. My guests today are Ann Slapia. She's with the Division of Environmental Services of the Municipal Department of Health and Human Services, and Scott Waterman of the Alaska Housing Finance Corporation. And our topic is indoor air quality. So if you're listening today and you have questions regarding anything you hear or questions you'd like to ask, we've got a couple of experts on air quality, particularly indoor air quality, and you can reach us at the following phone numbers, 550-8433. That's for those of you in the Anchorage area, 550-8433. And our toll-free number, 1-888-353-5752. And line one, if you want to send us an email, L-I-N-E-O-N-E, all one word with no spaces, at kska.org, will get you to us. We repeat tonight as a taped broadcast between 7 and 8, so if you're listening at that time, we can't take any phone calls or emails. Ann and Scott, welcome. Thanks very much for taking the time out of your day to come down.
Well, thank you.
Well, let's start with what I think is the most important question is, what are common biological and chemical products that affect us and as far as indoor air quality? Let's enumerate some of the big ones.
Well, let's see. I think I'd have to say that carbon monoxide would be the most significant threat for indoor air, particularly in a cold climate, especially in this season now that we've closed our houses up and are using our furnaces and heaters more. We can think of radon. We can think of pollutants that come from perhaps construction that we do during the winter, formaldehydes and glues and dust that's generated from activities that we do there. We could think of pollutants that are related to combustion and maybe burning of wood at this time of year. So it's a great time of year to think about what we have in our homes and what we do, what activities we're doing that might create that pollution. We could also think of perhaps even radon, simply because we're closing all our windows and so on, and it's a good time to maybe monitor for that.
Scott, anything you want to add to that?
Well, it's a pretty comprehensive list, but moisture comes to mind as one that is not really thought of as a pollutant, but it can lead to other problems.
Yeah, and the whole issue of allergies in general, we should perhaps mention, and it's a big issue with me because I do a lot of childhood asthma, and those sources would be mold that you're leading to associated with moisture, also moisture and temperatures associated with something called dust mites, which exist up here. I don't think there's big an issue here as they are in many parts of the lower 48, and then animal danders, which nobody wants to talk about.
There's that, and there's also the relative humidity that various bacteria and virus live in.
Right.
And at the higher ends and the lower ends of the spectrum, we get a wider variety of bacteria and virus that really seem to thrive at very dry conditions and at very humid conditions.
So while we're on that topic, I'll bring up, I often get asked questions about whether we should turn on humidifiers and vaporizers, and we're jumping into an area maybe more medical, and I'll try to get you guys back out of it, but it's a common question. I often say that from an allergy standpoint, from a health standpoint, from people I'm dealing with, we'd rather see it cool and dry rather than warm and moist. Now, you guys agree with that?
I would definitely agree with that. As we look at the building science of where do we want to keep our houses, is sort of what we call the happy box of what's comfortable for people and what's good for the houses. And the drier the house, the better off it is for the house. But real dry temperature or real dry relative humidity is not particularly comfortable for people. So we recommend somewhere between about 30 and 50% relative humidity in the wintertime. You can probably stretch that to maybe 20% on the low end, but I would really recommend not going much higher than 50% at the maximum end in the wintertime, because that really leads to some other indoor air quality problems and also some building degradation.
Mm-hmm. I know when I talk to you building experts, we get into microenvironments, and just because your hygrometer on the wall says 35 or 40 degrees relative humidity, it's not necessarily what it is in the basement or in your bed and
or
kitchen.
Even down as in the corner of the living room. Yeah, so, we've seen certainly areas of condensation that happen in corners of buildings where the relative humidity might be only 40% in the room on the wall.
Mm-hmm. All right, well, let's get back. I think the whole issue right now I think would be really important to talk about is how do we keep our houses warm and safe this winter, okay? Energy costs are up. We live in a cold environment. What are the principal things that people need to be aware of when they're thinking about keeping a house warm safely?
Well, let's see. I'd like to remind listeners that the what comes in your house is stands to be spread throughout the house, and so source control is probably the best thing you can do. What we have in our garages, for instance, and what we do in our garages is basically have too many fuels, too much equipment with gasoline. We tend to smoke in our garages as if that was really going to help the situations. We might have hobbies that we perform in the garages, and what we've found from doing indoor air studies and using tracers and tracer gases and so on like that is that what's in the garage comes and it's pulled up through the house and spread throughout the house by the heating system and so on. And so don't be doing things in the garage that you wouldn't do in your living room because basically all the pollution in there will come in sooner or later.
So we're fooling ourselves to think if we're painting in the living room, in the garage, or we're running some products that are having combustion products. It gets throughout the house is what I heard you say at the beginning. It's better to control the source rather than think, well, we're going to isolate some problems or you put an air cleaner in this particular room or something.
Yeah. Yeah, it definitely is an issue with when we make our buildings more energy efficient. We tighten up the shell. The major components, to answer your question, were probably the insulation and then the degree that we can limit the air leakage, the infiltration and exfiltration of air from in and out of the building. So as we make our buildings tighter and more energy efficient and we put a good quality heating system, we must remember to put ventilation air in. And that's a very critical piece. And our builders here in Alaska, when we started doing a real push to get more energy efficient buildings, at first they got the shell down really pretty tight, but they forgot the ventilation piece, and that led to some problems. Well, now I see a whole lot different attitude towards ventilation, and I'm seeing a lot more mechanical exhaust systems or mechanical ventilation systems that are really much better than what we were seeing even 5-7 years ago.
So we need to remember that if you tighten down a building so tight, then you're going to trap the condensation from breathing, from cooking, from bathing. Mm-hmm. You're trapping gases that are coming off out of, I know formaldehyde used to be an issue out of some pressed wood products. I'm not saying that's it, but any heating we're doing in the building, so all that gets trapped in there. So there has to be some way to ventilate that out.
Yes. And we think about air sealing the building by going around with caulk and foam and, putting a vapor barrier in and making the building tight that way. But there's other ways that we make the buildings tight, and sometimes they're not quite as obvious. You wouldn't necessarily think that changing out a furnace or a boiler would make the building tighter, but it can because particularly now when we start seeing sealed combustion appliances being installed in place of what we called atmospherically vented appliances in the past. There was a big chimney, maybe 6 or 8 inches in diameter, and we also had a couple of big combustion air holes in the wall to provide combustion air for that appliance. Now we have a sealed combustion appliance where there's an exhaust that takes the exhaust gases away, but there's also an intake tube on the inside of that that provides the combustion air for that appliance. So if we take that big chimney away, and we take those two big combustion air holes away, we've tightened the building considerably. We've blocked quite a big hole. So that can tighten things up. So we really need to make sure that we put in some sort of a dedicated mechanical ventilation system. And that can be as simple as a good quality low sone, which is a measure of sound, so a very quiet fan, low sone fan that exhausts, and it should be on a timer or probably a dehumidistat so that it runs maybe 15 or 20 or 30 minutes every hour, or when the humidity hits a certain point, it'll automatically come on and run until the humidity drops below that point.
Let me remind our listeners once again, if you have questions about what you hear today or questions in general about indoor air quality, there's a couple ways to get a hold of us. 550-8433 is our local number, 550-8433. 1-888-353-5752 is a toll-free number. And LINEONE, just write out the word line1@ksk.org, and you can send us an email. You got to do it between now and 3 o'clock for us to take it on the air, however. Before we came on the air, you all were talking about this issue that energy costs are up, so people are trying to conserve money, try to be as efficient as they can. I'm beginning to use wood stove or wood heat again. Let's talk about that. What's good? What's bad?
What comes to mind from an indoor air quality point of view is I worry that people will bring in wood that's not in good condition, has a lot of moisture in it, and moisture, mold, and dry it out in their living room. I've seen that, unfortunately. So that's one of the habits that's not good. We've had a lot of improvement in the wood-burning technology, and so I think that's very good. I know we changed out a wood stove recently to a more a newer model and have been really pleased by the efficiency of burning and also by the the fact that we really don't need to regulate it nearly as much as we used to. So we're a lot happier as far as that's concerned.
There's also the safety issue. As people burn wood, we need to remember to keep our appliances clean and get the chimneys scrubbed down at least once a year at a minimum. And if you have to burn it damp down for a long period, you're going to need to clean your chimney more often because creosote buildup and the risk of fire is really an issue. And, of course, as soon as you get a fire going in a building, that's a real big indoor air quality problem. So we don't want to see that. So properly sizing the wood stove so that you can run it partially open at least is the fire is going to burn hotter, the wood's going to burn more efficiently, and There's probably a tendency to oversize wood stoves. And when that happens, you end up building a fire, and it gets very hot very quickly, and then you damp it down and shut it down. You just barely let it smolder. And the creosote buildup in that and the pollution to the outside is also much higher then. So properly sizing the wood stove and get it sized so that you can burn it partially open for much of the time is really going to be a whole lot better off for your indoor air quality, for the health of your chimney, and also the health of the outdoor air.
See, I would have guessed that any kind of wood stove would have been of concern to indoor air quality and our health. But I hear you all, you saying that you can get a tight enough box that we're not going to have a lot of particulates and gases coming out that might be harmful, and that it is okay to heat with wood stoves if you know what you're doing.
I think if you have the wood stove sized properly and you have it drafting, the chimney is installed properly so that it's venting and you have a good draft, the air up the chimney, that's pretty critical. One of the problems that we have with our houses now, and some houses are built so tight that you cannot safely operate a wood stove in them. Mm-hmm. They have to have combustion air, and most wood stoves draw their combustion air from the living space, mm-hmm. from the space that they're located in. So if you have a very tight house, we can have a lot of aspects of negative pressure. There's all kinds of different things that can create negative pressure within our houses. We have bath fans and range hoods and clothes dryers and central vacuums. All these things can suck air out of the house. And if there's not a dedicated place for air to come into the house, then the wood stove can do what we call backdrafting. And this can also happen with water heaters and furnaces and boilers as well. So it's definitely an issue. We want to make sure that our appliances, our combustion appliances, no matter what they are, wood stoves, boilers, furnaces, Toyo stoves, gas fireplaces, that they're all installed properly. They have adequate combustion air, hopefully coming from outside now with sealed combustion or direct vent appliances. And then the proper venting to exhaust the gases outside the building. But if the wood stove is installed properly and it's vented properly, I think that the incidence of smoke coming into the building is pretty minimal.
Okay. Well, I think if you, for instance, I've used stoves that really needed a lot of tending, and if as that door opens and shuts, there is a lot of fine particulate that comes in the house. And we had a gentleman in town for a conference several weeks ago from Montana, and Libby Montana just did a wood change-out program several years ago. But one of the benefits of that, he said, was actually when they got the newer technology stoves that the indoor air really benefited because they could basically build the fire and the door didn't have to come open nearly as much. They weren't putting as much wood on. They didn't have to tend it so much, and that helped indoor air very much.
Mm-hmm. The other thing to remember that when a wood stove is using the air from the living space to support its combustion, it's going to dry the house out considerably because there's a fairly large volume of air going through that wood stove and exhausting up the chimney, and it's going to be drawing moisture from the living space. So it can dry the house out considerably. And back to your question about humidifiers, you may need to run a humidifier to keep the humidity at a comfortable level.
For humans.
Yes, for humans.
For what they prefer.
Right.
Not necessarily.
Not for the building. Yeah, we would say that that's probably a good thing to dry the house out. Mm. But if you do run a humidifier, be really careful that you don't over-humidify. And because the opposite problem of too dry a house is too much humidity. And if we have too much humidity, the stack effect or warm air rising will drive moisture into the attic and into the wall cavities. And you can get a lot of condensation, which can create mold and rot and wet insulation and a decrease in energy efficiency.
We have a caller. Katie, I want to go ahead and take your call. What can we do for you? Excuse me.
Hi. I have a question about radon you mentioned earlier
yep.
in the show.
Okay.
I was wondering if there are any geographic, I guess, qualities that make a house more susceptible to radon.
All right.
And how you go about testing for it.
All right. Katie, I'm going to ask our guest to talk about what radon is, where it comes from, and then we'll ask your specific questions. How do you test for it, and what are the geologic parameters that seem to increase the risk, and what's the risk right here in River City, so to speak? Okay.
Let's see. It's a timely consideration, because when we close our homes up, then things like radon become more important. There are certain geological associations with radon, but I think they have in the Fairbanks area, for instance, they have a kind of an area where more of the houses have higher radon concentrations. But it's probably best; it's inexpensive to test, and so we recommend that everyone do that. And this is an ideal time of the year. Radon is actually a radioactive gas, and it comes up through the soil because of some minerals in the soil that are radioactive. And it can come into the home if there are cracks and so on in the foundation through any gaps, and then also because our homes, if they're under vacuum, if they're negative pressure, it can help to pull that in the home. And so they have some fairly inexpensive ways to test. The Consumer Reports in September 08 just recently had a piece on easy-to-use systems for testing, and those can usually be acquired locally. We have a radon office up in Fairbanks. There's a gentleman up at UAF, and he is a font of good information. Radon is a fairly serious issue. It's the number two cause of lung cancer, and EPA reports that one of 15 U.S. homes has more radon or has radon concentrations above the recommended level. So it's a good thing to be concerned, and it's an ideal time to go ahead and perform those tests right now. The best tests are probably those of long duration, probably about a 3-month period. So if you can get some of these canisters and put them in probably some of the lower areas of your house, if you have a sub-basement or something like that, those might be an ideal place, and leave them in place for that period of time and noting the installation and dates that you cease to monitor, and then send them off, and they can mail you back a concentration. So it's very good information to have.
With 1 in 15 houses in the country having more radon than is recommended, how does, let's say, the Anchorage area compare with other parts of the country? I mean, there are high-risk areas, is my understanding, and I'm just trying to see if I can put this into a little bit better perspective. Is this a high-risk area, for example, or not?
Anchorage is not particularly a high-risk area. There's not a lot of data. The hotline or the radon hotline in Fairbanks, and I apologize for not having that number available. Maybe you've got it in there somewhere. Mm-hmm. But it's there is a radon hotline at UAF in Fairbanks. But the incidence of radon in Alaska is very scantily documented.
Wow.
And we know that there's some in Fairbanks. We know that there's some in the Mat-Su Valley. We have some increasing data from a few years ago, a little research project that was done down on the Kenai Peninsula that showed a higher level down there than we thought was possible or thought had been discovered previously. And there are a few places on the hillside here in Anchorage. But in general, down in the bowl, it's not much of a problem in Anchorage. There are some places in Eagle River and some of the surrounding areas. But it is because there's no centralized radon database, we don't really know other than a few small studies that have been looked at in various parts of the state.
All right. So to sum up what I'm hearing you say, this is a radioactive gas, comes from deep in the earth, from back when the earth was formed, and it can be pulled into the house, and it could be in certain areas of the country or in Alaska where it's at higher amounts. And the best way to tell is to get something that accumulates some readings over about a three-month period rather than just a short period of time. And there are consumer reports, you said, has given us some information. And do you have a number for the radon?
Yes. In Fairbanks, it's 1-800-478-8324. And what's nice about that office is it's staffed by a specialist in that if you do have higher concentrations, it's someone that could tell you knowledgeably some strategies for reducing them. So,
okay. All right. Good question, Katie. Back to the indoor stuff. We talked about fires or burning wood and so forth. Then your first thing you mentioned, Ann, when we came on the air about concerns was carbon monoxide, and we certainly hear about almost every year we'll hear about individuals who've died because of carbon monoxide poisoning. So let's make sure that doesn't happen again to our listeners. What do we need to know?
Right. Well, we need to have, of course, smoke monitors and CO alarms in homes. So it might be a little confusing. You might not really know which is which, but it's really essential to have to have an alarm in the house. These are not set. I'll let Scott speak to this, but these are set at a level that is really a warning. So one could have lower levels that might not be particularly healthy, but they're not the sorts of the levels at which you'd all take out the door and go running for the hills. So it's good to have the furnace. One should really have their furnace, boiler, and so on checked yearly anyway, and because that person will carry with him something to tell what the levels are down in that vicinity. And I've heard so many inspectors and so on say, you never know if it's a new system, it can still have a fault, and they should be checked. And again, this is an ideal time of year as we're starting up our furnaces and sealing our houses to take a look at these things.
Mm-hmm. So there's several sources in a home for carbon monoxide. Obviously, any internal combustion engines that we have in our garages. And as Ann was mentioning earlier, if you park a vehicle in your garage, it's just in many cases like parking a vehicle in your living room. So you have the potential carbon monoxide from your car engines, four-wheelers, lawnmowers, snow machines, if you run those in your garage. Then also within the house, any combustion appliance in the house, fireplaces, wood stoves, gas log fireplaces, water heaters, boilers, furnaces, space heaters, all of those can produce carbon monoxide. And the one that we don't really think about is our kitchen ranges. If it's a propane or natural gas kitchen range, there's a very high likelihood that at least some carbon monoxide comes off of that once in a while. And that is something that it doesn't really matter whether it's old or new. It needs to be tuned as well as you can. I one time went out and tested a kitchen range, and the box that it had arrived in the day before was still in the kitchen, and it had been installed. And I said, boy, that looks like a new stove. And he says, yeah, it is. It just was installed yesterday. He said the installer came out, hooked it up, turned it on, checked for gas leaks, and left. We tested it, and when it started up, it was producing 750 parts per million. which is very high and very much a concern. We burned it for a little while and monitored the level in the room, and the level in the room got up to about 20 or 25 parts per million, and it eventually began to settle out. But that was a brand new oven right out of the box, and it produced a fair bit of carbon monoxide. And when the burners get dirty, that can produce more carbon monoxide. So carbon monoxide is the result of incomplete combustion processes. And so if we have a boil over in the oven or on our burners and food gets into the orifices where the flame comes out, we can have problems with carbon monoxide. That can also happen in our water heaters and our gas log fireplaces and our boilers and furnaces. And it can also be the result of negative pressure. I mentioned the backdrafting issue earlier. Sometimes if the negative pressure is big enough, we begin to draw air down the chimney, and that can blow the flame onto the metal and cause incomplete combustion and carbon monoxide. Another house I tested one time, the water heater operated perfectly fine as long as it was in the full draft position, but we induced a negative pressure into the house, and the water heater began, when it backdrafted, producing over 1,100 parts per million. And we had to close everything off and open the doors and get out of the house for a little while it aired out.
Let me remind our listeners once again, this is Line 1. We're talking about indoor air quality with Ann Schlepe of the Department of Health and Human Services and Scott Waterman of Alaska Housing Finance Corporation. If you've got questions or comments, here's some ways to get a hold of us during the period of time between 2 and 3 p.m. Anchorage time. Locally, 550-8433, 550-8433, toll-free 1-888-353-5752, and you can email us at lineone, L-I-N-E-O-N-E, all one word, at ksk.org. Besides wood, what other fuels are people using out there to save money and stay warm that we may need to talk about?
Barley comes to mind. I had never heard of a barley heater until this summer. Uh-huh. But apparently there's someone that's selling a heater that burns barley out in the Delta area. Mm-hmm. So that's one. People down on the Kenai Peninsula have been using coal for quite a long time, picking it up on the beach. And out in the Sutton area, there's some local coal available. So there are a few coal-burning appliances around, and certainly in the Healy area. And we're seeing some solar hot water going in. And that's happening. That's actually turning out to be, at today's fuel prices, a cost-effective alternative. A system that might seem expensive and that it costs $10,000 or $12,000 to install actually pays for itself in 7 to 8 years, because there's no fuel cost once you capitalize the system. So solar water heat is coming into play, and it's not going to work, obviously, in the coldest months out of the year when our sun is very limited. But for about 9 months out of the year, starting in February and running through to October, we have a really good potential for solar water heat. So that's another one.
Yeah, are there risks that we know of associated with solar? Health risks?
No, not that I'm aware of.
Yeah, I haven't heard of any. I just thought we should ask the question.
Yeah, not with anything that I'm aware of with solar water heat, no.
Okay. Formaldehyde off-gassing had a hot period in my business a couple years ago. It seemed to have a lot of some concern, and I don't hear so much about it anymore. Do we need to worry about off-gassing of formaldehyde from plywoods?
I think a lot of the concern was in the building materials. And a few years ago, the glues that were used in the urea formaldehyde glues that were put together, they did seem to have a problem. I haven't heard too much about that lately. I know a lot of the structural plywoods and the OSB chipboard-type products are using a different glue now, and it doesn't seem to off-gas anywhere near as much. There's also almost all the major paint manufacturers are now using low volatile organic compound or low VOC compounds for their paints and most finishes. And I think a lot of the other things that we used to see that were problems, I know years ago I put down a Formica countertop on my kitchen counter, and we did it with all the windows and doors wide open and wore masks with respirators and all that type of precautions. And that doesn't seem to be as much of an issue anymore.
So the Darth Vader costume.
Yes. Uh-huh. Yeah. Yeah.
Don't worry about it.
So it's what I have noticed. I've picked up some furniture that has seemingly off-gassed for a couple of years. I guess I shouldn't buy inexpensive furniture, but anyway, I think they may use it to sort of speed cure the wood, and it, you know, I can detect it for a year afterwards. So anyway, save your furniture purchases for springtime or sometime before the windows go open, or yeah. Don't buy inexpensive furniture.
Yeah. Here's one that I may be springing on you, but I read an essay just this weekend about silver and where silver is becoming a problem. First off, mercury is a very, very, can be a very toxic chemical. And right after that comes silver, and there's been some problems of silver getting into the environment and causing significant problems. But where silver is becoming an issue, and it's apparently very poorly regulated at this time because nobody knows what to do with it, is on all of this nanotechnology. They're using very, very tiny amounts of silver. It's going into clothing. It's a very good antimicrobial, all right? So it's going into clothing, it's going into washers and dryers, and it's getting into the – it is there increasingly, but it's not clear how much of a risk it is and how it's going to get into the environment and who should have responsibility on that, because it kind of is unsure whether it's an EPA or environment. I don't know all the different organizations that are supposed to do this, because it's almost like in some foods and things even. So have you all heard anything about that? And I, like I said, I'm springing it on you, and it's mm-hmm. kind of new, but it's an issue that's maybe beginning to raise its head.
Well, I think if the size of the particles is probably as much a concern as the material.
Right.
Because if you're using it in nanotechnology, it's going to be very, very tiny, right. tiny particles.
Right.
And you probably could address this better, but my understanding is our respiratory systems can filter out, our cilia and mucous membranes can filter out larger particles, but they can't do the ultra-fine particles.
Right. Right.
And so I guess from a health standpoint, that would be the concern is, you know, silver is probably never, you know, if you shaved coins in the past, you weren't going to get as a tiny enough piece to inhale it and get it, you know, ingested. But now if it's going into food and clothing, then that, you know, that in very small particles, that is a concern.
Yeah, and there has been some questions about the nanotechnology and some of these fine tubules and related to illnesses similar to asbestos because of the same issue. It's a structural inhalation. So let's talk about asbestos. Again, 10, 15 years ago, it was a huge issue. Lots of money spent trying to get rid of asbestos. Where are we now? What do we need to be concerned about?
Well, mostly the hazmat courses for asbestos abatement still happen. And if you are going to have any kind of asbestos abatement, do not do this at home by yourself. You know, call a professional. That's something that I wouldn't touch with a 10-foot pole myself, because I haven't been through the hazmat training. Asbestos is mostly a concern when it's in what we call a friable state, and that's the place where it's beginning to come apart, and those tiny little fibers can break loose, and we can inhale those, and they get encapsulated in our lungs, and that's where it becomes a problem. So asbestos was used predominantly in homes in pipe insulation, in some very old, very much older homes. That probably hasn't been used since the 30s or the 40s. So probably most homes in Anchorage are not going to have asbestos in their pipe wrap. We also have seen people that do a lot of mechanics and brake work or clutch work. If you're doing that in your garage, that can actually get a fair bit of asbestos fiber in your garage, which then is easily tracked in through the home, and that can be a bit of a problem. The other place that asbestos in homes was used was in homes pre-1978 as a filler for what we call the popcorn texture on the ceiling. And the it was just a spray-on texture that got painted over, and it was a real heavy, rough finish. And that should probably be removed with caution, and I would sample it before I tried to remove it in my house, because I don't think I'd want to just willy-nilly take it out. But a lot of people really didn't like the look of it, you know, in modern day. It's a very rough, craggy finish, and so a lot of people would like to have it removed. A better option might be to just go over it with another layer of drywall and encapsulate it, and then put a texture of your choice on the new layer of drywall.
I looked up, knowing we might be touching on this, I looked up where one would go to find an inspector or someone qualified to deal with this. And apparently the DEC, Environmental Conservation, with the state, has a number for the Alaska Office of Mechanical Inspection. I guess they register such people. So that has a phone number, 269-4925.
Okay.
And so that would be a resource people could use.
You know, go ahead.
I was going to say what reminds me is similar, you know, sort of a small compounds. Lead has mm-hmm. been that EPA has recently reduced the lead regulatory level to about a tenth of what it was previously, which was somewhat of a surprise because for years it remained the same. But anyway, they're saying it's very unsafe. They point out activities within the home. It sounds a bit like asbestos. I think paint before 1978 had lead in it, and so or could have lead in it. And so anytime we're sanding or doing those type things, it's something to consider.
We especially find that in some of the older homes if you're replacing windows, because a lot of the window trim may have lead paint on it. And there are what we call lead-safe work practices. And if you can kind of mask off the window from the inside and do most of the replacement from the outside, put a drop cloth down underneath so you're not dropping paint chips and whatnot onto the ground, and try not to do any sanding of any of the wood that you remove. But as you pull pieces off, put it on the drop cloth that you have and don't just throw them out on the lawn or whatnot. Try to contain your work area as much as possible and always use a mask and goggles and gloves.
On the lead issue, there's another thing from a medical standpoint, which is interesting, is the Academy of Pediatrics asked most pediatricians to screen kids for lead toxicity. It's almost never positive in Alaska. In fact, the state's looked at that very closely. It's not much of an issue, mainly because we don't have the paints that were contaminated. But what has been found is that where we do see lead toxicity is in indoor shooting ranges.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't shoot, but it has to do with the lead that is in shot, I guess.
Mm-hmm.
And there have been, you know, higher levels documented in individuals. I don't want to overstate it because I don't know exactly. I'm not sure illness, but certainly higher levels in individuals that do that more. So that's
the other risk here in Alaska is people that make their own shot.
Right.
Okay. If they're melting and heating lead to make their own bullets, that can be an issue here. And another house that I saw a lead problem in was one where there was several batteries that had been opened and were exposing to the atmosphere. And the lead plates the electrolyte had dried out of the battery and the plates were exposed to the atmosphere. And that was seemingly contributing. There was still some activity going on, but these were open batteries that were still being used, charged and discharged, And I think that was a problem in that particular house.
Now, what about water? It, was that long enough ago, the 60s pipe and solder and so on, that we don't worry about?
There was lead solder used here up and through the mid-80s and even into the early 90s for soldering copper pipes. And I haven't seen how much of that is leaching out. A lot of older homes have lead solder holding the pipes together. A lot of newer homes are using plastic pipe, so that's no longer really much of an issue. And the solder is now silver-based solder rather than lead. So we may have stepped from the frying pan into the fire on that, but who knows. But it's a non-lead-based solder. And I don't know how much of that actually leaches out into the drinking water.
As I recall, I live in a home in Turnigan, which is built in the 50s, and the water company, whoever, I don't pay the bills, my wife does, but they actually asked us to sample some water, or people did, and we didn't find any issues because of the concern about lead and solder.
I've read quite a number of the water quality reports from various places around town, and I haven't seen lead as being an issue in those. And they are sampled from the tap, so.
You know, we haven't talked about, from a medical standpoint, the number one contributing factor to lung health or health in probably worldwide is cigarette smoke. And we kind of haven't really touched on that. A lot of regulations now have, I think, clearly are being demonstrated to decrease emergency room visits, hospital. There's several national studies looking at regulations have been instituted that decrease smoking in facilities like restaurants and bars, that you can actually measure the acute respiratory illness standpoint, and it's clearly, I think, it also is associated with long-term respiratory health, particularly with lung cancers. Do y'all want to say anything about that, or have I said enough already?
Well, you've hit the high points. I guess in our client education, when we do that sort of thing, we usually go to the kids and say, if mom or dad is smoking in the house, we put a ventilation system in. We say, turn this switch on, and maybe get mom to sit over here right under the intake, mm-hmm. Or the exhaust of the ventilation system. So that's generally been my approach, and I work with the children in the house.
Mold. You guys must get questions about mold, and we've already talked about relative humidity and the importance mm-hmm. of keeping things cool and dry. We all kind of agreed on that too, within a certain framework. How much of a problem is mold, and what can we do about it if we're worried about it?
In the houses that I see, and I have a tendency to get into 100 to 150 houses a year and have been doing that for quite a few years. But I have seen mostly small amounts of mold in most of the houses. I have seen a couple of houses where there was substantial amounts, but mostly it's relatively small amounts. Maybe there was one I was just in the other day, and in the corner of a closet that was on outside walls, there was maybe a 6-inch by 2 6-inch by 6-inch triangles in the corner of mold, right in the lower corner. And that's a small amount of mold. I would say anything less than 10 square feet in total area of blackened sheetrock or paint is a small amount, and usually not of great concern. Most of the time I see it in closets where people have put boxes up against outside walls. Sometimes I'll see it in apartment buildings where there's people walking by the windows and the drapes, floor-to-ceiling drapes, are closed for privacy. And that has a tendency to cool the area under the window, and condensation can occur and mold growth can happen there. And then the other place that I'll see it is in areas where insulation has been either disturbed or not properly installed in the first place, and there's a cold spot that's causing condensation. So I don't see mold as a huge problem in most places, but when it is significant, it's very significant.
We've had such a wet summer that we had a call from a nurse several months ago, and she said she she believes that some of her patients were having some respiratory distress having to do with mold, and asked if we could provide some materials. Some of my actually EPA produces some of my favorites. There's one called A Brief Guide to Mold Moisture in Your Home, and that's good in that it talks about, you know, humidity and a bit about health and how to clean up and how to prevent it, primarily. So it's something to think about. Obviously, any kind of leak in the roof, moisture from the ground, high water table, all of that is something to act on right away. If there's any kind of a flooding a fixture in your home that flooded some portion, dry it all out right away and take care of it, because it only takes a couple of days for mold to get a foothold if mold has feet. So that's something that people should keep an eye on.
In a parallel comment, it's important to remember that there is quite a bit of mold outside, and so your exposure to mold indoors is not the only place. And molds can perhaps cause illness. Most primarily, the biggest source of health problems are with allergic relationships to molds. But again, many of the same molds that are indoors doing that are also outdoors, if not more so. We have a caller from Palmer, a writer from Palmer, sent me an email. Says, I'm listening to the program right now about heating homes and have a question. Is it cheaper to turn down the heat? Here comes a mom and dad argument, mother and father are over the dinner table, which is right here. Turn down your heat overnight during the day when people are not at home than it is to maintain the home at a constant temperature. What do you think? They have lots of windows everywhere that are drafty. They've had frozen pipes in the past. They're renting the house, so they don't have a lot to say. They have three sources of heat: propane, natural gas, and a wood stove. They don't use a wood stove very often because it needs attention to the chimney needs some attention. So they're trying to figure out what's the right thing to do.
All right. Well, from a cost standpoint, those three different fuel sources, when you calculate the cost per 1,000 BTUs of British thermal units, which is the amount of energy it takes to raise 1 pound of water 1 degree Fahrenheit. So we measure heat in terms of BTUs. The cost per 1,000 BTUs of natural gas is less than that of wood or propane. So I would say from a heating, you know, cost efficiency standpoint, use your natural gas more than the wood or the propane. Get your wood stove chimney fixed and cleaned and safe before you use the wood stove again. And it can be a very nice source, especially if you have a free source of firewood. And when I say the cost of wood is more expensive than natural gas, that's if you're buying it at about $185 a cord. So the issue of turning the thermostats down when you're at night or when you're gone during the day will save some energy. And for every degree that you turn it down over a 24-hour period, it's about 2% on your monthly fuel bill. So if you can kind of average that out, say you turn the temperature from 70 degrees down to 64 degrees when you're gone and at night. And with a setback thermostat, you can program it to bring the heat back on before you get up in the morning and before you get home in the afternoon. That will save you some energy, and it works. As far as, you know, having the frozen pipes, you know, one of the primary causes of frozen pipes is air infiltration. And you'll get a draft that's leaking in, and particularly in windy areas. And I heard Palmer gets a little windy once in a while.
And they're saying they don't have the greatest insulation in their wall. So.
Right. So the air sealing of the house is probably going to be a fairly important one. But again, when you do your air sealing, make sure you provide for proper ventilation.
Okay. Thanks very much. Other comments? Nitrogen dioxide, something we haven't heard much about. Is that something we should mention? That's another off gas that gets some attention sometime.
Well, in my mind, I package that with combustion products, and like any of them, they're all they should all be outdoors and not inside your house. There are stoves and so on that are not vented out of doors. They simply have something to sort of catch a little bit of grease and shoot it back out. I'm not sure. I don't imagine they're code anymore, but some of the larger stoves these days are actually burn quite a bit of natural gas at a single time. And of course, some of the hoods they use to vent those can create a negative pressure mm-hmm. for quite a bit of the house. So that's a difficult balancing act. Of course, you don't want these products in your home, but on the other hand, seemingly those vent fans are
it's rather amazing to see commercial grade equipment going into residential buildings, you know. And oftentimes you have a commercial kitchen. It's a fairly large kitchen, and for the range hoods or the vent hoods that go over a cooking area, in the commercial code, for every cubic foot of air that leaves the building, you have to have a dedicated supply air to come in so that you don't get that negative pressure. But in homes, I heard about one last week, a 1,600 cubic foot per minute range hood. I mean, that's one that you really have to, like, not walk by with a new infant because it'll just get sucked right through. It's the kind of thing that is way – I mean, it's like a magnitude of order difference in what we are typically using for – range hoods. Typical range hood is
a little as good, more is always better. Right.
But when we do that, we have to be very careful about the negative pressures we create.
Okay.
So if we're putting a big oversized Viking kitchen range in and a huge oversized hood, we better be starting to look more towards the commercial code for proper ventilation for that than residential codes.
All right. We only have about a minute left or so. Are we better off with indoor air quality in Alaska and Anchorage in the United States than we were 10, 20, 30 years ago? Do we know that for...
I think we are. The building science has really progressed a lot in that mm-hmm. period, and we have a much better understanding of how buildings work, how heat, air, and moisture move through a building, and I think we're quite a bit better off today than we were 15 or 20 years ago.
True. I think we focus on our weak spots, but if that's our comparison, we certainly are.
Final thoughts, the final things you want people to have heard from today in the last 30 seconds or so.
Well, I think indoor air quality deserves a little bit of concentration, a tour of the home, consideration of the rooms, what are the risks in the different rooms, take a look in your garage, see what you can jettison. Is everything turned off with your fuel and capped and so on? It's just a good seasonal exercise.
I'll close with build it tight, ventilate right.
Oh, okay. I like that. That's sweet and very good. Well, thanks very much. It's been my pleasure to have Ann Slapia and Scott Waterman with us today talking about indoor air quality, and thanks for all you do.
All right. Thank you very much.
Appreciate it. Next week, we're going to be back again, and we're going to be talking about dyslexia. A lot of people have heard the term. They may not understand it completely well. So we'll be talking with Marilyn Anderson and Doris Cerny of the Gateway School and Learning Center in the Anchorage area. So if you want to learn more about this particular topic, dyslexia, and what can be done about it, why don't you tune into Your Health and learn more Monday, November 3rd at 2 p.m. And remember, we repeat this program each evening at 7 p.m. on FM 91.1. And you can go to KSKA at any time and listen to our previous programs. For KSKA and for Line 1, this is Dr. Thad Woodard. Have a great day.
This has been Line 1, Your Health Connection. If you have questions or comments concerning this program, write us at 3877 University Drive, Anchorage, Alaska, 99508. Or email us at line1@kska.org. Additional information on today's show topic, including relevant website links, will be posted along with audio of today's program on our website at kska.org/line1. CD copies of this program can be purchased by calling 550-8400 during regular business hours. This is KSKA, Anchorage.